From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Welcome to Worldviews. Earlier this week, anti-American protests in Iran marked 34 years since the storming of the embassy in Tehran. I'll talk about the anniversary with Joshua Landis, who also provides a brief update on Saudi Arabia's frustration with the U.S. over Syria.
We said we were going to bomb Assad. They were furious when we turned around and made a deal to get rid of chemical weapons in Syria without bombing them.
And later, Boston University modern European historian Jonathan Zatlin. He says parts of Europe's debt crisis can be explained by religious tension between the Protestant North and the Catholic South.
And that nasty little ethnic moment keeps on coming back in ways that I think make it harder to discuss the actual problems of economic asymmetry.
But first, the news. Josh Melandis, welcome back to the roundtable.
Pleasure to be back.
First of all, let's acknowledge the fact that 34 years ago this week was the beginning of the Iran hostage crisis. And obviously, since that time, we've had extremely poor to, well, no relations, really, with Iran. But we're starting to see things change, perhaps, right? A little bit of a thaw in that relationship, recent conversation over the phone between presidents of both countries, discussions, you know, working together on the nuclear issue. What can we say about Iran's, the U.S.-Iran relationship right now?
Well, we do seem to be at a crossroads. And Rouhani, the election of this new president, who has fluent English, is charming and has really carried out this charm campaign to try to get to some understanding with the United States. And that's largely because sanctions are really hurting the Iranians. The currency has collapsed. People are feeling poor. So Iran is doing this dance and saying that it will put its nuclear refinement and move what the West fears is movement towards the arming and a nuclear weapon on hold. It wants the West to recognize that it has the right to refine uranium. They claim they're not moving towards armament, but you know, obviously nobody believes that. So we have promised Israel and ourselves that we would not let Iran get the bomb. So and we would bomb them before that happened. So this is a big – you know, Obama does not want to get into another war in the Middle East and certainly not with a very big and important country like Iran, 80 million people. So there we are.
So the talks are ongoing, and I guess
they're talking
where they're
right
headed,
now.
It's hard to say, but talking is better than not talking.
A lot of
positive vibes. Some might say.
We'll see.
Well, speaking of not getting involved in another war in the Middle East, let's of course talk about your area of expertise, Syria, but particularly the other countries in the region that are very concerned about Syria. And so we just had Secretary Kerry going to the Middle East, visiting Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Israel, all these meetings focused on what to do about Syria, and I guess fielding some questions about why the U.S. isn't doing more about Syria, particularly from the Saudi perspective, right? The Saudis, is there some concern now about what the Saudis might do?
Saudi Arabia is very upset. They're upset that we're talking to Iran. They're upset that we are considering lifting sanctions on Iran. They're upset that we haven't done anything on Syria. We said we were going to bomb Assad. They were furious when we turned around and made a deal to get rid of chemical weapons in Syria without bombing them. They want the rebels to get a real win. And America's saying, we've got to move to the peace table. There's no military victory here. And we're talking with Assad. They're furious.
We're talking with Assad about the chemical weapons.
About
issue.
The chemical weapons. But we're also talking about peace. We've invited his delegation to a Geneva II, which has fallen apart. But we're trying to push the rebels and the Assad regime to discuss a ceasefire. And that infuriates many people in the Middle East, to Sunni powers in particular, because it seems like a win for Iran. Assad is still going to be there. The rebels are hanging in the wind.
So the Saudis are thinking, we'll just take over, basically, in the sense that we're going to start training the rebels. We're going to start, you know, engaging more. So so that's concerned. But what? So do we really care about that? Why should we care whether Saudis do or don't do this? I mean, isn't that their, you know, right to do that?
You know, I suppose it's their right. But America and Saudi Arabia are allies. We want to be on the same page in the Middle East. And we're very worried about the growth of al-Qaeda in Syria because the rebels, the al-Qaeda militias, of which there are two, have become the strongest militias in rebel-held Syria, about half the country. And we're worried that Saudi Arabia, if they go in there and start arming up people, will help grow al-Qaeda. So America is trying to get to the peace table. We don't want Saudi Arabia sending in a lot of arms and money. That's our major concern. So we have some major differences with Saudi Arabia, but Kerry was there to smooth them over as much as he could.
Well, definitely going to take a lot of diplomacy in this case, I suppose. Tricky and complicated situation as always. Joshua, it's great to have you here. Thank you so much for talking about the Middle East with us. If you have any thoughts about this discussion, you can leave a comment on the Worldviews page of our website, kgou.org. You can also contact me or Joshua through Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU or at Joshua_Landis. Or at Suzette Grelot. Coming up, I'll talk with Boston University historian Jonathan Zatlin. He's studying the link between race and economy in modern European history, specifically the experience of German Jews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. After World War II, the Allies divided war-torn Germany into four zones of occupation. Three of those zones united in 1949 to form West Germany, but the other Soviet-controlled zone remained within the Eastern Bloc sphere of influence for the next four decades. Boston University historian Jonathan Zatlin studies this part of the world and says there's a lot to learn about Europe's modern debt crisis by examining the beginning of the Cold War. Jonathan Zatlin, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
Let's first start with this issue of East Germany. You do a lot of work on East Germany and the eastern part of Europe, but basically focusing on various European issues. But can we start by kind of going back and thinking about historically what really was East Germany, you know, the differences between it, let's say, geographically, politically, economically, socially, culturally? I mean, how remind us of what those differences were between East Germany and West Germany or East Germany and the rest of the West?
I think maybe we could take one step back and say something about the division of Europe and that it really takes place inside of Germany, so that you have a divided nation, but that a divided nation that is a tripwire for all the tensions between the West and, in the beginning, at any rate, Stalin's Soviet Union and Stalin's attempt to restructure Europe. And part of the concern that Stalin had, and I think it wasn't paranoid at all, was that a united Germany pose certain kinds of security threats. There had been two world wars. Both times the Germans had invaded the Soviet Union. Germany was a tremendous economic power. And so there was a fear on the side of the Soviets that maybe the West would use Germany to, in fact, invade the Soviet Union. And in fact, General Patton made some pretty incendiary comments right after the war saying that we needed to march all the way to Moscow and recruit the Germans in that drive. So this wasn't a fantasy. And I think that although Austria, which is also occupied by the Soviets as well as the Western powers, doesn't become divided, that really the difference has to do with the economy, that's what drives the division of Germany.
So just explain that a little bit. The economy is what drives it. So we get the politics, right? We get that there's this Germany and the rest of Eastern Europe kind of seen as this buffer zone, right, between Russia or the Soviet Union and the rest of the West. But what do you mean by the economy driving it?
Well, the German economy was very large. And despite our sense that, in fact, a lot of the Allied bombardment had destroyed German plants and factories and what have you, actually that wasn't really the case. And you had a highly trained workforce. So the concern that Stalin and other people have is that Germany might be able to rebuild its economy. And since it hadn't been particularly well integrated into Europe in a lot of ways, Europe in the 19th century is built on a weak Germany, a powerful France, a powerful Russia, with the British trying to somehow or another maintain a balance of power. But once Germany is unified in 1870, it becomes this colossus. And so the question is, how do you restrain it in some way? And I think that makes sense for a lot of people who might have fought in World War I or grew up hearing about World War I and then are in position of political responsibility in 45. They really want to prevent another war from being unleashed. And it's not, I don't think, a question simply of German culture and German institutions. It's also a question of this economy and how it tries to dominate and trade with other partners. So the question is really how to do this in a peaceful way. And if the entire German economy had been integrated into the West, I think from a Soviet perspective, this would propose a really serious security risk. And then there are about 80 million Germans. If you're going to actually plan an assault, a military assault on the Soviet Union, then you have even more men you can put into the field of battle.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Zatlin, a modern European historian at Boston University, who's written extensively on the economy of Germany in the 20th century. We'll talk about race and the economic experience of German Jews in the second half of our show. I'm Suzette Gorelott, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest is Jonathan Zatlin, a modern European historian at Boston University. Just before the break, he described how Joseph Stalin viewed a unified Germany as a threat to the Soviet Union at the end of World War II. So let's fast forward then to the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and very quickly after that, a reunification of Germany. Tell us a couple things about that. First of all, how did they overcome that notion that a unified Germany would be a threat? Because there was some concern, I think, and some hesitation on the part of some that reunifying Germany was a concern. But also, you know, how different really were these two countries, if you will, East Germany and West Germany, by this point in time, decades down the road, in terms of kind of cultural, social, you know, way of life issues that inhibited in any way or facilitated perhaps them reunifying in 1990?
On a superficial level, it looks like West Germany and East Germany are very much connected to each other because they both speak the same language. They can both point to Goethe and Schiller and Beethoven and people like this as being part of their cultural heritage. But I think you're absolutely right. By 1989, there were a lot of differences. So first of all, West Germany had become a country in which you had an enormous amount of democracy. Institutions become democratized. There's a lot of freedom of religion. Religion plays a very great role in politics. You have a Christian Democratic Party that rules Germany for most – West Germany, rather, for most of its history. And in the East, the Communist Party is very good at actually loosening people's ties, de-Christianizing, if you like, the country. So that there is still a tradition of Protestantism in particular, and people have deep ties to it at one particular level of values. But in terms of actually going to church, and part of this is the power of the state actually trying to prevent people from going to church and harassing church leaders and pastoral leaders. But part of it really is just the general idea that you all belong to a community that's not formed around any kind of religious or ethnic lines. In fact, what you've got is a planned economy, and the idea is that you're all working towards some kind of end through that. And that's not how West German society functioned. The other thing I would point to is that the planned economy actually meant really that people were dealing with scarcity all the time. So where the West Germans start to get nice consumer goods like refrigerators and cars by the, let's say, the end of the 1950s, early 1960s, it's within reach of an average household to buy an automobile, a refrigerator, a television set. It's not a question of money for East Germans. It's a question of scarcity. They just don't make enough of these goods. And in fact, they're told all the time to not worry about consuming things. That's what the bourgeois types in West Germany do. So even if you don't believe that, you don't have the car. You don't have – or later on, maybe you get a chance to have the car. But to get the car, you have to do all sorts of things. And if you don't have the car, if you're crammed into a small apartment that has a leaking ceiling or whatever, you're dealing with some kind of economic deprivation. And that shapes not only the way you think, but it shapes what you actually do. So I would argue that by 1989, people had all sorts of different practices that didn't look similar in both countries. Not only that, but there was a way that East Germans had of thinking that they were – even if they disagreed with the regime, that there was something more moral about East Germany, not because it was a totalitarian country. In fact, the argument was that the communist dictatorship was really – I think most people felt this way, that it was a terrible thing and that's why you get a popular revolution. But at the same time, that there was something really good about the lack of commercialism, the fact that people were encouraged to read and write quite a bit, and that somehow or another West Germany was superficial and commercial and Americanized and what have you. And the problem, I think, is that once the communist dictatorship collapses, you still have this notion from the East German side that there's something special and unique about East Germany that needs to be preserved. And they don't really bring that much to the table, in fact. There's, in terms of economic assets, there's dramatic pollution. You're talking about factories that are outdated. The country has very skilled and highly disciplined workers, but if you are dealing with old plant, then they're going to be out of jobs. There are very few resources, natural resources that the East Germans have, so they don't really bring that much to the table. It's smaller, much smaller. It's about a third the size of West Germany in terms of its population. So they can be ignored politically in a somewhat safe way at the level of national politics. So they can make arguments about their let's say their cultural superiority to West Germany. But that's not going to sway many people politically. And at the same time, what's so fascinating is that you actually have the emergence of leaders like Angela Merkel, who was an East German and became involved in politics and is now the chancellor of the country and probably will continue to be chancellor.
So despite or perhaps in spite of all of these differences and distinctions that emerged throughout that time, Germany did reunify. It is the strongest economy in Europe, but yet it's Europe has been struggling. We've had the European financial crisis going on for some time. Germany is coming down where on this? I mean, they seem to be doing better than others. Also, others are looking to them to help. What is their position on this, and how has their history kind of helped them manage this particular crisis that they're dealing with today?
So I guess I would start off by saying that although the country was unified, it wasn't particularly well integrated, which means that the 17 million or so East Germans, many of whom have actually moved to West Germany, that the people who remained are not economically and politically well integrated into the country. So when you talk about Germany today, you have a situation that's actually somewhat similar to what's going on in the rest of Europe, where you have a center that centers around Germany and France in particular, and then a periphery, say the Iberian Peninsula. And what's odd about the situation is that there seems to be no public recognition that some of the problems that East Germany has encountered are being encountered in the rest of Europe. So you use, for example, a central bank and money to integrate or, let's say, unify the country. This is how European Union – but you don't have the political mechanisms and the cultural mechanisms to do this. So very quickly there are institutional problems that show up. So that's, I would say, a curiosity, and I'm not sure how to explain that other than that Eastern Germans, generally speaking, don't have the ability to articulate this based on how they are somewhat marginalized. And when they aren't marginalized, they're not thinking in those ways. They've taken on a very West German approach. And that approach, I think, when you talk about history, it's the West German experience of maybe American occupation. So you have all of these Nazi institutions and you want to democratize. And the democratization doesn't work very well. Nazis managed to remain in positions of economic and political influence. And this is perceived as not a good thing. And so you want to take the chance to make sure that institutions are not corrupt, that they are not driven in a way that's going to help elites retain power, that in fact things are democratized both politically and economically. So when they look at a place like Greece, I think people tend to sit there and say, well, those are corrupt institutions, and what they really need is somebody to help them revitalize those institutions. And our institutions are not like that. Why should we be asked as taxpayers to distribute or redistribute our money if their institutions are corrupt? And I think the problem that is – you detect it in the way in which people talk about things. There's also a divide going on that is about Christianity. The northern countries that are Protestant and this idea that somehow or another northern Europeans are hardworking and industrious, whereas southern Europeans maybe a little lazy, maybe a little less rule-bound. And that nasty little ethnic moment that Europeans, despite World War II, despite the Nazis, and despite the way in which the communists tried to, on the one hand, get rid of this way of thinking but actually ended up reinforcing it, that this keeps on coming back in ways that I think make it harder to discuss the actual problems of economic asymmetry in this part of the world.
So let's very quickly then connect this issue to what you're working on today, and that is the connection between race and particularly religion in terms of the Jewish connection to economic issues. What are you specifically talking about in this work that you're doing now?
Well, I want to think about the Jews just as one potential case. In other words, you could think about other either ethnic minorities or different religious ways to think about how what is legitimate in terms of economics. When I'm making some kind of a business transaction, how should I be doing it? What's okay? What's not okay? What is the kind of business I shouldn't be doing? So in the German Jewish case, which is what I'm looking at, I started in the 19th century, and you can see all sorts of interesting ideas that Germans have about Jews in particular. And this idea, for example, in 1880s, there is a synagogue outside of Berlin that is destroyed in a fire. And it's anti-Semitic violence, and you can make all sorts of arguments about how that fits into a larger and increasingly vocal minority of Germans who want to strip Jews of their civil rights. And you can also make parallels, say, for the United States after Reconstruction and the way in which the South is governed and the kind of extra legal means that people use to make sure that African Americans don't enjoy full civil rights. But what I'm actually interested in is the way in which people explain this. The synagogue is burned down, and the argument that's made by a lot of local leaders, not of the Jewish community but of the Christian community, is that the Jews burned it down themselves. And they did this to get the insurance money because they want to build a bigger synagogue. So this, on the one hand, this attention to finances, this reduction of the spiritual values to financial values, which is a really old idea about what sorts of approaches Jews have to money and the economy. And on the other hand, this idea that people would actually destroy their own house of worship and inundate the rest of Germany. They would get bigger and bigger and become some kind of threat in some way to what is German culture, which has a lot to do with trying to figure out what it means to be German. So this is sometimes a violent kind of discussion and sometimes a one which people simply are trying to figure out what it means to be German, what it means to be Jewish. And of course, we know that the end of the story is a very unhappy one in which the Jews are told that they are not Jewish, and that legitimates both the plunder of German Jewry as well as their eventual extermination.
Well, Jonathan Zatlin, thank you so much. It's a very interesting topic, and we'll be looking forward to reading more about it. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Boston University European historian Jonathan Zatlin about race and economics in Europe from the 19th century to today. There's more information on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews through a collaborative partnership with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski edits the audio and writes our online content, and Hillary Gibson prepares the research for our interviews. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Grelott.